All right. Well, I want to begin today by talking about the love languages. If you're a Christian, you've probably heard of these love languages. A number of years ago, the author, Gary Chapman, wrote a book called The Five Love Languages. It's a perpetual bestseller, one that's a near constant presence on the New York Times bestseller list, as well as the Christian bookstore lists. And like so many bestselling Christian books, it is one in which I see some genuine strengths combined with some appalling weaknesses. It's a book that demands that we heed the old cliche to chew the meat and spit out the bones. So what I want to do, at least the first part of it today, is to offer a critique of the whole idea of love languages and then show how I've found them to be useful. Well, here's the book in a nutshell. Each one of us has a love tank that's continually running empty. And if you love me, what you need to do is to find out how to fill that love tank. And the way you do that is by learning my love language and speaking that love language. Now, that may be acts of service, it may be physical touch. There's five of them that he comes up with, right? There's a number of different languages. So what you need to do is to study me, learn to speak that language, and that will be you showing love for me. Okay? That's kind of the basic premise of the book. So at the heart of the book is a description of those five ways in which people tend to be wired, or ways in which they tend to have love expressed to them. Okay, affirming words, gift-giving, physical touch, quality time, acts of service. And Chapman believes each of us has tendencies towards some of these and away from others. And now each of us can probably look at that list and order them, some kind of ranking, 1 to 5. Some of us love being served, while others of us love receiving gifts. But for others, acts of service and receiving gifts, are not as meaningful. And so, there's in his wisdom and kindness, God has made us to be different. Even in the ways we give love and receive love. And so, Chapman writes, I think I have this here in your notes, love can be expressed and received in all five languages. However, if you don't speak a person's primary love language, that person will not feel love, even though you may be speaking the other four. Once you are speaking his or her primary love language fluently, then you can sprinkle in the other four, and they will be like icing on the cake. Well, there's no doubt that Chapman touches upon something real here. I just need to only look at my own marriage and see that Cheryl and I both have our, at least in his terms, our own language. The ways that I can best express love to her are through quality time and acts of service, while the way I love to receive love from her is through words of affirmation and physical affection. And of course, Chapman's idea is that I find out from Cheryl how she likes to be loved, then begin to love her just like that. So quality time is at the top of the list. I'll be sure to give her a lot of quality time. Now, implicit in this is that she will return the favor. She'll learn my love language and love me that way in return. And according to Chapman, when we follow this model, a happy marriage will ensue. And so in this way, he gives us a somewhat helpful way to describe the different ways we're wired and gives us a realistic way of putting these love languages into action. Now, just on that, that can all be helpful. However, as I mentioned, the book has some very notable weaknesses. And I think there's a couple flaws that we need to think about and point out. And once we see those flaws, then we can learn how to use his observations even better. Now, David Powelson has written a fantastic review of the book. I think it's an article in one of the Journal of Biblical Counseling. I commend it to you. I think you can download it for free online. Might be wrong about that. I'm just going to track with him for the next few minutes because he says it way better than I can, and then I'll kind of add my own thoughts and return to them later. Here are the flaws that Paulson points out. The first one is that love languages may actually simply mask selfishness. It's possible that I am actually using a love language that you appreciate in order to manipulate you so that you give me love. In other words, I'll speak your language that you speak mine. Or I will speak your language to the degree or the extent that you speak mine. Kind of tit for tat. And this may actually be a kind of back and forth that we've negotiated that we will speak each other's languages. So honestly, primarily, we can feed our own desire to be loved. And after affirming some of the book's strengths, Powelson looks to the golden rule, right? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And he offers this commentary. Obviously, the most basic violations of the Golden Rule occur when we simply mistreat others, doing and saying malicious things we'd hate to have done and said to us. But perhaps the most common misunderstanding of the Golden Rule is that even in attempting to love others, we do what we would want. It's a less heinous form of self-centeredness, more clumsy and ignorant than hateful. Now, this is important to see in this whole context of love languages. If I respond best to physical touch, then the way that I will express love to my wife is through physical touch. However, physical touch may mean very little to her. My expressions of love, then, are actually selfish. I'm only giving what I long to receive. Now, at its best, right, the five love languages can correct this. But the reality tends to be a little bit different. The foundation of the book is that as I give my wife the kind of love she wants, she will reciprocate with the kind of love that I most want. And Paulson says, what is Chapman working with here? Unwittingly, he exalts the observation that even tax collectors, Gentiles, and sinners love those who love them into his guiding principle for human relationships. Right? Do you see it? Identify the felt need and meet it, and odds are your relationships will go pretty well. And that sounds pragmatically useful, but it doesn't sound much like Christian living. There's another big concern. Love languages really aren't even a thing biblically. They're not love languages, they're love desires. These languages simply show how I desire to be loved. Love me as I long to be loved is in a certain way a fair request, but it can also begin to sound like scratch my itch, or worse, bow before my idol. So as we look at the Bible, we know that, right, we can't trust our desires. I know I'm a sinful person. My desires are deeply flawed because I myself am deeply flawed. My desires may simply point to my idols, those things that I'm convinced of, that unless I have this, I cannot be happy. I cannot be joyful. I cannot feel love. And Paulson says, and I think I have this here in your notes. I do, yes. Love languages are part of the story of human relations. But speaking love languages is surely not the whole story. In fact, it is practical, immoral wisdom, manipulation or pandering or both, when it becomes the whole story. Part of considering the interests of others is to do them tangible good. But then to really love them, you usually need to help them see their itch as idolatrous and to awaken in them a far more serious itch. That's basic Christianity. And then he says, five love languages will never teach you to love at this deeper, more life and death level. So in demanding that, or expecting that Cheryl love me as I long to be loved, or in loving her in the way she longs to be loved, I may be bowing before idols. Hers or my own. Now, what the five love languages can actually do is teach us that the desires we feel within, desires that may truly be lusts, are actually needs. And as soon as we see them as needs, we have deviated from biblical Christianity to human psychology. Okay, Chapman's whole premise is, his whole model is premised on a give-to-get economy. I will give to fill your love tank, but in the back of my mind, I'm always considering whether and when I'll get my own tank filled. And in Paulson's words, he says, five love languages replaces naked self-interest with civilized self-interest. I give hoping to get. Now, we begin to see how this model conflicts with our earlier definition of love as willing self-sacrifice for the good of another that does not require reciprocation or that the person being loved is deserving. All right, so now we've got two big concerns. One, that there is an inherent selfishness with the love languages, and that they may be at heart a form of idolatry. So where fundamentally does Chapman go wrong? I think it's in this. He assumes what we feel as needs are fundamentally good. He never deals with the fact that people can desire evil. Chapman never deals with the fact that even desires for good things can still be evil desires in God's analysis of what makes us tick. Your love language is a curious mix of creation and the fall. And so at the heart of this five love languages is a fundamental misunderstanding of the fallenness of man. We are sinful to such an extent that even our deepest desires, things we may consider needs, may be inherently sinful. When we understand our natural depravity, we are prepared to look at God's love for us and see that Christ's love language is one that none of us desire. And I think I have this extended quote here, and I just want to go ahead and read it. The love of Christ speaks a love language, mercy to hellishly self-centered people, that no person can hear or understand unless God gives ears to hear. It's a language we cannot speak to others unless God makes us fluent in an essentially foreign language. We might say that the itch itself, an ear for God's language, has to be created because we live in such a stupor of self-centered itchiness. The love language model does not highlight those exquisite forms of love that do not speak your language. You and I need to learn a new language if we are to become fit to live with each other and with God. The greatest love ever shown does not speak the instinctively self-centered language of the recipients of such love. In fundamental ways, the love of Christ speaks contrary to your love language and felt needs. Does anyone naturally say, I need you to rule me so I'm no longer ruled by what I want? Does anyone naturally say, for your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my iniquity, for it's great? Does anyone naturally say, my greatest need is for mercy, and then for the wisdom to give mercy? I long for redemption. May your kingdom come. Deliver us from evil. God's grace aims to destroy the lordship of the five love languages, even while teaching us to speak the countless love languages with greater fluency. And then he goes on, the love of Christ controls us in that one died for all, and therefore all died, and he died for all so that they who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and rose again on their behalf. Grow fluent in the love of Christ, the love language that no one speaks naturally or hears, but everyone needs. All right, so do you see this? The saving love of God, centered in Christ, expressed in the death of Christ, does not speak anyone's natural love language. And yet, it is the greatest love and our most desperate need. And so in this way, Christ, you know, fails the love language test. We wanted to be loved in all sorts of ways, but none of us wanted to be loved in the way Christ has loved us, by dying for us, by sending the Spirit to indwell us and becoming Lord over us. And yet, this is what we have needed more than anything else in the world. Now, in the next section, personality types, right? Here's where I think Paulson's offered some tough critiques, but this should not cause us to miss what can be truly valuable in the book. So let me return now to a couple of ways that I found the love languages to be useful, and then we can open this up for some discussion, okay? So how do we use love languages well? Well, first, we use them to point to the variety of ways that there are to be loved. If you have five children, as I do, chances are you've got five people who like to be loved in different ways. And there are many different ways we can give love, many ways we can receive love. And that's amazing. God has made us to be different, and that's healthy and good. And it's wonderful to explore the variety of ways we can love and be loved. Here's what Paulson himself says about different personality types and ways of expressing love. I think I have this quote too. God makes people with wide variations of temperament, personality, interest, and motivation, overlaying the core commonalities of human nature. He arranges and governs wide variations in life experience, opportunities, socialization, and enculturation. Also adding coloration to core commonalities. These variations on the human theme find expression and are often marked individual differences. Furthermore, the Lord of all the earth often seems to put people together in marriage who are wired differently. As a result, either we grow to complement each other by learning to give intelligent love, or we incinerate the marriage on the battlefield of insistently different demands. All right, so in the first place, right, it's just helpful, just an observation to categorize ways people can be loved, and ways to express love. And this is open up, hopefully, a panorama of ways that you can express love to your spouse. Now, he only offers five categories, but they're sufficiently broad and point us to endless ways that we can express love, both in terms of affection and action. So just in that terms of, you know, observational level, the book can be helpful for seeking to love your spouse. And at the same time, it's been valuable to see ways in which you or your spouse may make a desire, a need, a lust, or an idol. And of course, it does the same thing for you. You can see that in maybe your spouse and in your own heart. I've been amazed to see how the language I speak best can be the language of idolatry. as Pallison says, he says, I found that one acid test of my heart is how I handle being misunderstood, caricatured, reviled, dissed, not how I handle being accurately known and loved. It's when someone doesn't speak my love language that I find out what I'm made of, and by God's grace begin to change what I live for. So it can be helpful in that way. Okay. Another way to redeem this whole model, and I think this is the most important of all, is to look at another person and understand, all right, how does that person want to be loved? And then turn it around and say, well, that's exactly the way that person is most likely to love me. And if that person loves physical touch, that person will touch me as a sign of love. Even if it means nothing to me, right, I need to learn to receive that as they're expressing love for me. So you see, we're not primarily talking about how to give love to one another, but how to receive love from one another. And so I think it can be helpful to just turn it around. I find it helpful to see the ways in which Cheryl longs to be loved because it's taught me how she's most likely to express love to me. Now, she and I can express very different languages and can leave both of us feeling unloved. But once we come to understand that our languages are different, it can begin to open up our ears and our eyes to a whole new way of expressing love. It turns out, right, it's not that she wasn't loving me, but that she was loving me in her own way. And I had maybe closed my heart or ears. I think my metaphors are getting mangled here. But closed myself to those expressions of love. But then once I understood her better, then I was prepared to receive love in different ways and unexpected ways. And this has brought far more benefit, I believe, than demanding or even hoping that she will learn to speak mine. Okay? Now, how do I know that the love languages are flawed but can be redeemed? Because Jesus Christ did not speak the language I wanted, right? He spoke the language I needed. And that is the heart of the gospel. I wanted him to speak in all sorts of languages. He spoke in the language I needed most. And that proves to me I can't trust what I want or what I desire. Instead, I always need to look to him and to his word to define what love is. Okay? Now, I've just said a lot. Thank you for letting me get through that. I want to open it up. Have you guys interacted with this book? Wait, things maybe you found helpful if you've interacted with it. Things you found unhelpful. Let's talk about it. Dennis.
I'm sorry I missed the first part.
Sure.
So, but I, from what I'm understanding is there were some difficulties with it. And I read it a while ago. Mm-hmm. And so I don't remember exactly everything. But I do remember being frustrated at the end of it. For one thing, I couldn't discern which was my love language, that maybe I had more than one, or I just wasn't sure, but I really like what you said about this makes sense to me now, that, you know, my husband doesn't speak my love language, I don't speak his, and coming out of that book, I expected him to change and give me what I needed. And I have had to learn since then, unfortunately you weren't teaching me then, that I needed to appreciate, I'm sorry, that really okay, let me.
I understand what you're talking
about. No, the part about learning to appreciate the way he expresses his love to me, and appreciate that even though that's not what I want. And let me share this example, because this is kind of cute. When I'm trying to lose weight, he would come to me with a smile on his face and a hunk of chocolate in his hand and a glass of milk, and here you go, honey. And I'm like, it was like a puppy dog bringing me his toy, you know.
We need to work on analogies.
I'm sorry. But it was good for me to realize I need to see that, you know, he just was so proud of himself. And I needed to appreciate that, you know, that he really, truly wanted to please me. But he was still learning me. So I'm sorry. Does that help?
That's kind of the whole point of what say it's helpful is learning to see our spouse's expressions of love in their language to us as them actually loving us rather than being selfish and demanding that they love us.
And I wondered coming out of that book, because I remember trying to, you know, talking to him about it, and he hadn't read it, and expressing that frustration of, I'm not even sure what my love language is, and now I have to figure that out anyway. It just, it didn't completely address how to show love, I felt.
And people change too.
And to receive the love.
You know, you might take the quiz in your 20s, and that you might retake it in your 40s or 60s, and different things. And so that's kind of where the paradigm can be limited, right? Is we try to pigeonhole ourselves into one kind of way and make that the paradigm for how we feel loved. And I think that's where it's not helpful.
Yeah.
I think it's this book or personality types or Enneagrams or any of the stuff that the evangelical churches taken on that becomes a larger part of the whole society, you know, whatever it is. It's just another example of a movement that the evangelical church has been swept up into, and I've fallen into that, so I understand. But I think it really just points us back to the wisdom of understanding Scripture, you know, and we're supposed to live with our lives in an understanding way, and we're supposed to know our spouses intimately, and if we're doing that, it doesn't matter what the latest fad is or what the latest book that tells us how to apply that to our lives. It's applying Scripture and knowing our spouses. We don't need to know their love language, we need to know them well and apply Scripture.
To piggyback on that, the whole discussion that you just, whole thing you just talked about reminded me of the character counts thing where you're trying to form a character, like the schools are teaching kids good character without Christ. And, you know, we're all lost. And it's the same kind of thing. It's the same thing where you're trying to love your spouse in an artificial way. And I don't know, I see where those two kind of connect.
I wonder how many people in this room, when they read the book, saw the flaw in the book. Obviously, you did, right?
Eventually.
You pretty quick, huh?
With Paulson's help, yeah.
Okay. So, when I read the book, I didn't immediately see the flaw. I'm just curious, can we do a show of hands about who saw this flaw, or is that...
Well, maybe, yeah. I don't know if you needed to take a survey. But I think you're hearing comments from those who have interacted with it, that there was some recognition of those flaws, Brett?
I appreciate what you said. You know, you brought out, and actually, if I may, I don't want to just pile on books while we're at it, but what you brought out about the reciprocal part of that book, I actually think a little bit about that Love and Respect book, which I really like, but it has some of that same language. If you love, you will be respected. If you respect, you will be loved. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like promised in that book as well as the other. And what you said about, you brought in Matthew 5, or 5:46, if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? I really thought that was interesting because that's exactly right. I mean, basically what's being promised is a shallow, not necessarily a shallow love, but it's not a love of Christ, which is completely selfless and does not require reciprocation. Mm-hmm. And I think does all of us who've been married a long time or a little short time, you promise them that if they do this, they will receive that. It's doing a disservice to what the Bible asks for.
Right.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, we're supposed to love for better or for worse,
that's
right?
Right?
So in those times when they're not reciprocating,
that's right.
Still supposed to be loving. Any other comments or questions about it?
I've never read the book. Not enough pictures for me. it's fascinating to think about. Yeah, okay, so I need this love, and so now Mark needs a dish out because that's what I want. And so that's interesting. The way I found the concepts helpful is with children, mm-hmm. in that, like, Mark shows acts of service. You need something fixed, he's there for you. And I'm affirming, yay, let's go. And so that I think that's confusing for kids sometimes because, okay, if dad loves me, he would say yay, but he's not going to. And so I remember sitting down with my oldest saying, okay, he was frustrated with that, and I'm like, no, he does love you, but he just shows that in a different way. He's not probably very seldom going to say yay. He's got different shades of okay. Okay, and you got to figure out what okay you got. And that's okay for him, okay? And I accept that, but I think small children sometimes don't understand the different love languages. Like, I don't like that term, but you know what I'm saying, the shades, and I think that's helpful for children, maybe, or is that all?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think what's helpful is seeing how we can receive love from others and the way that they're expressing it to us. Yeah, Ben?
I also didn't read the book because, you know, pictures and stuff. But one thing it helped me with was when I'm not feeling particularly loved and I see Nikki doing things like cleaning the house and washing the dishes and the acts of service that is how she's always expressed love, that I don't tend to notice unless it's right in front of me. And it helped open my eyes that, yes, she does love you and she is trying, and maybe that's not the one that means the most to you, but give her credit for trying. Yeah, and, you know, just be a bit more understanding of your wife. And it, the concept, talking about it with other people, kind of helped point that out to me.
I also have not read this book, but
not a requirement.
I have heard enough about it that I, you know, feel like I have, but I haven't. But this, I think the power of suggestion can play a big role in it too, because once you've decided, oh, this is my love language, then that colors everything, because now you suddenly only feel like you should feel loved if it's in this way, and it just kind of skews your understanding of how you receive, how somebody is showing love to you, and whether they're doing it right or wrong. And, oh yeah, I understand, but I still think they're doing it wrong, you know? And it can screw things up a lot if they're not careful.
Yeah, just like with languages here, it's helpful to be multilingual. And I think that's Paulson's point, right? Love learns to speak many languages fluently and to receive many languages fluently, and not only be able to hear it in one language. One more comment.
I'm sorry, I just have one thought based on everything that I'm hearing from everybody, and I wonder if one redeeming thing you can gather from the book perhaps is that if you feel unloved, look at your spouse and see, are they giving me any of those? Maybe I'm not seeing the love that they're giving me.
Yeah, or even beyond those. Yeah. But that's, I think, the helpful paradigm is learning to see in multiple languages ways that they're expressing love in action to us, not just a kind of narrow way that I prefer. Let's move on, because I have some more things to say. But that was, if we can talk about that more, maybe on a panel or something. But that was a good discussion. Thank you for your contributions. And hopefully that helps put a little bit of a different analysis. I encourage you to get that article from David Paulson and read it in full if you want to really dive into what he has to say about it. It's very, very helpful. All right, so all right, even with all our zeal to carefully define cruciform love in the first part where we looked at last week in the context of marriage, you might still be fuzzy as to what this kind of love looks like at the ground level. So these, I have just 22 statements here, and 22 axioms from Paul Tripp, concrete descriptions of how real Christ-like love thinks and acts, okay? So this is going to bring together many of the themes we've discussed so far in this class, not just in this lesson. And I'm just going to read them and give some brief commentary. And as you listen, I invite you to use these words as a mirror to look into and examine the quality of your love for your husband or wife. Number one, love is being willing to have your life complicated by the needs and struggles of your husband or wife without impatience or anger. This should bring two things to mind. First, you should be reminded of Jesus, who is willing to face all the complications of life in this fallen world in order to meet our greatest need, which is new life. You should also be confronted with the fact that you don't like your life to be complicated. You don't want your plans interrupted. You don't enjoy having to deal with problems you've not anticipated. One of the great challenges of real love is the willingness to abandon your demand for a comfortable and predictable life. And one of the most important calls of love is to find greater joy in meeting the need of another than in getting your own way. 2, love is actively fighting the temptation to be critical and judgmental toward your spouse while looking for ways to encourage and praise. It's so easy to be picky and irritable. It's often easy to be better at catching your spouse doing what is wrong than to recognize the many places where they do what is right. When you forget who you are as a sinner, failing to recognize your own weaknesses and failures, it is much easier to be critical of your spouse. And critical responses to others are always rooted in self-righteousness. That's what we talked about. It's when we're affirming our own need of grace and celebrating the grace we've been given that we delight in giving grace to the person we live with. 3, love is the daily commitment to resist the needless moments of conflict that come from pointing out and responding to minor offenses. You're a flawed person living with a flawed person, and if the paradigm of your relationship is to jump on every failure or offense, no matter how small, there will be no end to the hurt, conflict, and disappointment in your marriage. Love is sympathetic. Love is understanding. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love doesn't delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. You have married a person in process. That means by God's grace that your spouse is better than she was yesterday, but not what she will be tomorrow. Your husband or wife will fail in little ways every day, so it is important to recognize what is important and needs to be lovingly addressed, and what is insignificant and needs to be lovingly overlooked. And in both instances, it is important to give grace. I could say a lot more about that. We had some questions about when do you cover over sin, when do you confront. There's a really helpful article online, again, from the Biblical Counseling Coalition. I can pass that link on to you another time. He gives some really helpful practical suggestions on when to overlook an offense and when do you need to confront somebody. 4, love is being lovingly honest and humbly approachable in times of misunderstanding and being more committed to unity and love than you are to winning, accusing, or being right. It doesn't matter how unified you have become and how comfortable with and knowledgeable about one another, you will still face situations of misunderstanding. One of the benefits of marriage is that we don't look at life the same way as our husband or wife. But that can create misunderstanding in the marriage. It's also true that we don't always communicate clearly as we think we do. We also don't always hear as well. There are times when our mind is so engaged and thinking about how to communicate our own perspective that we're not actually hearing what our spouse is saying. And then along with these things, you and I are prone to changing our minds. We learn, grow, we reconsider, and we often don't communicate those changes that happen along the way. So the unity of marriage is not the result of absence of misunderstanding, but rather the unity of a marriage is formed as you work through inevitable misunderstandings with patience, kindness, and grace. 5, love is the daily commitment to admit your sin, weakness, and failure, and to resist the temptation to offer an excuse or shift the blame. It's so tempting to believe you're more righteous than you actually are. It's so tempting to erect excuses and defenses for the wrong you have done. It's so easy to point out the sin of your husband or wife while being blind to your own. Self-righteousness is a daily spiritual war that all of us must face and be willing to fight, and it's only when we're doing this that we will be owning and saying no to patterns of thought, desire, word, and action that get in the way of what God has called us to, and so fall below the level of the love that is the daily calling and protection of a marriage. 6, love means being willing, when confronted by your spouse, to examine your heart, rather than rising to your defense or shifting the focus. As long as there is remaining sin in us, we all carry around inside ourselves that inner lawyer, ready at any moment of challenge, rebuke, or confrontation to rise to our own defense and present arguments in support of what we have done. Well, love means being willing to fight with these defensive instincts of your heart. It means refusing to be closed and defensive. It means being unwilling to turn the tables and work to convince your spouse that you are not the only sinner in the room. Love means admitting that you need your spouse to help you see yourself with accuracy. And love means being willing to own your wrongs, to examine them in the light of God's word, and to confess them to God and to your husband or wife. 7, love is the daily commitment to grow in love so that the love you offer to your husband or wife is increasingly selfless, mature, and patient. Right? Love means not living with your feelings of arrival. Love is not lazy and self-assured. Love means accepting the reality that God is still calling you to grow and to change. To love another person means you're willing to admit there are places where your love needs to grow and to mature. When you love your husband or wife, you'll be committed to personal honesty and personal growth so that you can increasingly love your spouse in a way that is more consistent and more mature and more biblical. Love doesn't coast, but always carries a personal growth agenda. 8, love is being unwilling to do what is wrong when you have been wronged, but to look for concrete and specific ways to overcome evil with good. We see this in the behavior of children. You see it in the anger of the elderly and in everyone in between. Right? It's very tempting for all of us to hurt another when we have been hurt. Right? Hurt people, hurt people. It's tempting to speak unkindly when we have been spoken to harshly. It's very tempting to act in anger when we have been the object of the anger of another. Proverbs warns about don't associate with an angry man lest you become like him yourself. Right? There's anger breeds anger. It's very tempting to treat our husband or wife with disrespect when we feel we have been disrespected. It is not naturally our response to look to do good when we have been wronged. It's not natural to look for ways to love a person who has hurt us. It is natural for sinners to push back when we've been shoved. And so if we're ever to concretely overcome evil with good, we need the intervention and strengthening of God's grace. And we must admit that we find it hard to do good in the face of wrong. Not because of what is inside the person that we live with, but because of what is inside of us in our own hearts. 9, love is being a good student of your spouse, looking for his physical, emotional, and spiritual needs so that in some way you can remove the burden, support him as he carries it, or encourage him along the way. Now, my description I'm going to talk about in terms of sheets, just to make it balanced, okay? So love is not only reactive, it is willingly self-starting and active. It is good when your husband or wife communicates a need and you willingly respond, but real love is more active and aggressive than this. It finds joy in studying her, right? Her opportunities, responsibilities, temptations, gifts, weaknesses, strengths, family, friends, schedule, and so on, so that it may anticipate her needs and move quickly to meet those needs or support her in the middle of them in whatever way is possible. Right, so love doesn't wait around to be told what is needed and what to do. Love never sees her needs as an interruption. Love is burdened when she is burdened and finds joy in her relief. If you really love your husband or wife, you'll be willing to increase your load in order to lighten his or hers. 10, love means being willing to invest the time necessary to discuss, examine, and understand the problems that you face as a couple, staying on task until the problem is removed, or you have agreed upon a strategy of response. All right, we live in a broken world, problems will come. They won't always go away with the passing of time. You'll face relational problems, personal problems that impact your relationship, and problems that come from outside your marriage. And as much as you would like to, you will never exercise the kind of control over other people, locations, and situations that would be necessary to keep your marriage problem-free. In fact, though, these problems are often a good thing, these trials, in that God uses them to take you beyond your own strength and wisdom to learn what it really means to live together in dependency on Him. So a good marriage is the result of two people who have learned together to be active problem solvers, and then have learned to celebrate the growth and the change that results. 11, love is being willing to ask for forgiveness and always being committed to grant forgiveness when it is required, or when it is requested. All right, you are not yet perfect and neither is your spouse, and so forgiveness is an essential calling, as we've talked about. You will say some wrong at some time. There will be a moment when you desire what is wrong. You will act, react, or respond in a way that is wrong. You will be selfish, unloving, unkind, irritable, or impatient at some time. Really, there's probably never a day when we don't sin against one another in some way. And so it's vital to recognize that your spouse has to live with a person like you, still struggling with temptation and sin and still failing in some way. And you should find joy in relieving the burden of living with you by seeking your spouse's forgiveness whenever he or she has been impacted by your sin and your failure. It's also important that you are ready and willing to forgive your spouse as well. You can't be in a marriage without being sinned against in some way. Again, I love that book by Dave Harvey, When Sinners Say I Do. It's inevitable. So you must say no to keeping a record of wrongs. You must say no to vengeance of any kind. You must say no to bitterness. And you must always be willing to grant forgiveness whenever there has been an offense and your spouse is seeking to make things right by asking your forgiveness. And again, remember, we talked about that's a vertical commitment, recognizing God's own forgiveness of us that then empowers our horizontal forgiveness. Number 12, love is recognizing the high value of trust in a marriage and being faithful to your promises and true to your word. We've already examined some, the importance of trust in a healthy marriage, and we're going to continue to do so in future lessons, so not much needs to be said here, but it is worth connecting love and trust in this way. Right, love loves, trusts, and works in whatever way possible to strengthen the marriage. Because you love your spouse, you want her to know that she can depend on you, and you want her to be free of the need of following you around and checking up on you. You want her to rest assured that whatever you promise to the best of your ability, you will do. And whatever you say to her will be reliable and true. Love also means living with your spouse in such a way that he never has to wonder who you are with or what you are doing when you are apart. Love means your spouse can rest knowing there are no secrets in your life or subtext in your words about which he needs to be concerned. Number 13, love is speaking kindly and gently, even in moments of disagreement, refusing to attack your spouse's character or assault his or her intelligence. I think this is one of those four rules, right, Bill? Attack the person. Attack the problem, not the person. Attack the problem, not the person. And that's kind of what this is getting at here. The old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, could not be further from the truth. All right, long after physical bruises have healed, the wounds of words still live in the heart. And I've seen the peace and hope of a marriage destroyed by horrible words that should never have been spoken. They're difficult to remove from the memory once they are said. So when you are hurt or engaged in a high-stakes disagreement, it's very important to edit your words, not giving yourself permission to go on the verbal attack. If you want to have a marriage of unity, understanding, and love, you cannot allow yourself to say whatever you think or go wherever your emotions are leading you. Right, love says no again and again, not to your husband or wife, but to yourself, right? Self-denial, resisting the temptation to get your way by using words as weapons of warfare rather than as tools of love. 14, love is being unwilling to flatter, lie, manipulate, or deceive in any way in order to co-opt your spouse into giving you what you want or doing something your way. This is kind of like the love languages gone haywire, right? It is an act of love toward your spouse to keep yourself aware of the war that still rages in your heart between the kingdom of self and the kingdom of God. It is a commitment of humble love to daily acknowledge your struggle with the selfishness of sin. It is your calling to resist the temptation to use whatever tools are at your disposal to get your husband or wife to submit to the agenda and rules of your little kingdom of one. Now, love serves and gives. Love is not complaining or demanding. Love is being willing to sacrifice what you want in order to get give your spouse what he or she really needs. Love is never deceitful or manipulative in the pursuit of self-interest because true love is other-centered and other-motivated. 15, love is being unwilling to ask your spouse to be the source of your identity, meaning, and purpose or inner sense of well-being while refusing to be the source of his or hers. I really struggled with this early in my marriage. If you really do love your spouse, you won't try to turn him or her into your personal Messiah, and you won't want the power and buzz of being your spouse's Messiah. Your husband or wife is not capable of carrying your hopes or happiness. Your spouse cannot be the reason you get up in the morning or the thing that keeps you going during the day. To ask your spouse to do this is not only an act of spiritual selfishness, but it also places on him or her a burden they cannot bear. If you do this, they will fail and then have to deal with the consequences of their failure and your disappointment and the negative impact all this has on your marriage. So love means you never ask your spouse to do for you what only God can do. Love never demands from your spouse spiritually what God has already given you in Christ. Right? So love seeks vertical fulfillment so it can horizontally serve. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the next lesson, being content in Christ. Love is the willingness to have less free time, less sleep, and a busier schedule in order to be faithful to what God has called you to be and do as a husband or wife. Right? Marital love means you're willing to give up your individual control over your time, plans, and schedule in order to build real and lasting friendship, intimacy, and communion with the person you have committed your life to. You cannot think, choose, or decide as one, and at the same time be committed to the unity and love of your marriage. Right? Love is willing to give up your right to control your time, energy, and resources. Love is willing to add more duties to your living, more complication to your schedule, to get up early and stay up late. And love is willing to do all these things because of the joy of serving your spouse and helping her experience what God says is best. I'm just going to try to get through these real quick. I'm sorry, guys. We have about 4 minutes. 3 minutes. Number 17, love is a commitment to say no to selfish instincts and to do everything that is within your ability to promote real unity, functional understanding, and active love in your marriage. There's probably no more important commitment of love than the commitment to say no. If you're ever going to say yes to the moment-by-moment call to make personal sacrifices for the good of your husband or wife, you must first say no to yourself. Because, again, the DNA of sin is selfishness. So as long as sin remains inside you, there will be a constant temptation to live, act, react, and respond to your spouse in a way that is self-focused and self-centered. If you're ever going to live a lifestyle of real love, you must first fight this battle of the heart. And like any other war, this battle can only be fought in the concrete, that is, in moments of specific temptation that greet you and specific locations and situations. Okay? I can say more about that. Number 18, love is staying faithful to your commitment to treat your spouse with appreciation, respect, and grace, even in moments when he or she doesn't seem to deserve it or is unwilling to reciprocate. Again, no one has been or ever will be married to a perfect person. Marriage means that the sin, weakness, and failure of your husband or wife will be your firsthand daily experience. It means loving your spouse when she is having a bad day or struggling with a particular disappointment. Marriage means loving your spouse when he is irritable and impatient. It means loving your spouse when she has hurt you in some way. It means loving your spouse when he is demanding and critical. It means continuing to love even when your spouse refuses to participate, cooperate, serve, give, or help. It means persevering through hard times and difficult days. It means refusing to use words as weapons or let the sun go down on your anger, even when your husband or wife is doing both of those. Right? Love is never letting the failure of your spouse become a reason for changing the rules of the game. True love is respectful, looks for ways to express appreciation, finds joy in giving grace, wants to build and encourage, and love, true love does these things no matter what. You know what? We are out of time. So what I'm going to do is next time, I'll finish this. I think I have like 4 more of these. And then we can open up to discussion, and then we'll move on to the next lesson, okay? So if you have jotted down some questions or thoughts as I was going through those, say that for next time, and we'll pick it up next time. Sorry about that.